All right, ladies and gentlemen around Delaware Valley, welcome to the Pain and Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks. We're sponsored by Tony Shore and Pinnacle Medical Plus. I'm Joe Dougherty. We have a fantastic show today. Sonny, how are you?
I'm doing great, Joe. I'm certainly doing a lot better than those Eagles.
Yes. I was all my plans for the parade. And, you know, we're certainly, you could have expected it to an extent. I mean, but, we're eternal optimists here. We have people, actually talking about the possibility of, the path to the Super Bowl.
Sure.
And
there was a lot of talk about the first game was fairly close. What was it, 28-24? But that game was not close.
It wasn't. Yeah. Even though Tampa left themselves one play away from us, really potentially making a comeback, the truth is, even this score, 31-15, was not nearly, as close as the score, as we know. But the GOAT is the GOAT. And they have a fantastic, team and they're beat up though. Tampa Bay's beat up, and we'll see what happens. But
we need to retool a little bit, especially I think the offensive line, secondary.
I would love to see the defense. I would love to get that linebacker from Georgia, man.
Oh yeah,
that guy is an animal.
He sure is.
We need a middle linebacker. I mean, we need
that would energize the entire team.
That's right. I'd love to retool the defense. I'm a Jalen Hurts fan. I think.
I'm too.
He's a young guy. One of the things, and of course the coach, he kind of went back to his first, went back to his first 4 or 5 weeks in the NFL where he was making calls. Everybody folded in the presence and in the shadow of the GOAT. Mm-hmm. I guess when you're Jalen Hurts and you're a young guy and you realize you have to score every time, and the coach is feeling the same way. Let's see what happens. I mean, listen, Brady's only got another 10 years left. So, it is what it is. But
he'll be playing at 65.
Yeah, he will be. I mean, he doesn't get touched. He doesn't do anything. He's out there playing, like, touch football with everybody.
Right.
And, certainly, although I will say that, I always pull for Brady, of course, except for with the Eagles. So, they played some bad games this year, so there's no guarantee. It's going to be a tough or it's going to be a great weekend of football coming up. If you will, introduce our attorney.
Absolutely. Attorney Gary Bailey is with us today. Gary is no stranger to you, as you both have done radio together in the past. Gary Bailey is the founder and owner of the law firm of Bailey & Associates, located at 1500 Walnut Street, Suite 204 in Philadelphia. Gary has had his own firm since 2014. He limits his practice to multiple areas of personal injury as well as civil rights cases. Gary Bailey is a graduate of Temple University Beasley School of Law. He has extensive trial experience, which allows him to confront large corporations and insurance companies without fear of going to trial if necessary. Gary Bailey will personally give your case the individualized attention it deserves. Gary, if you would, please remind our listeners about your background and about your law firm.
So I started in 2014. Started off doing just a little bit about everything because my idea was I wanted to help everybody. I was ambitiously ignorant to an extent.
Did you open your own firm right out of law school?
No, but actually it was within 3 years, which is unheard of. I worked for two local firms doing personal injury and then doing subrogation work. And what I found out was I wasn't a great employee because I always wanted to do more. I wanted to take every case. I wanted to work on every case at the end of it. I wanted to spend the boss's money. I wanted to spend extra time of the firm's resources. Like it was just so much that honestly both firms that I worked for gave me the best launching pad that they could give me. The first firm was Lassiter & Associates with Dwayne Lassiter. What he did was throw me into all of the litigation that I could handle, all the arbitrations, all the conferences, deposition, et cetera. The second one was Saltz Matka. And what they showed me was how to do all of the motion practice, understanding the rules, civil procedure. Mm-hmm. So I was completely fortunate to have two firms to teach me two separate things.
What was the second firm?
Saltz Matka.
Okay.
And because they taught me both sides of litigation from two distinct perspectives, it gave me pretty much everything I needed to at least attempt to go out on my own. Now, a little bit about my background. Before I went to law school, I did finance for 10 years, from insurance, investments, banking, even had some of my own contracts. So I was fortunate that I conceptually understood how to run a business, worked for those two firms where I had both sides of the litigation model put together. So I just said, you know what, I think I'll be able to find another job if this doesn't work.
Right.
I was scared out of my mind the day that, you know, I quote unquote hung my shingle. And interestingly enough, the phone just started ringing.
Wow.
And it kept ringing, and God willing.
Did you have any of your own work when you started your own firm?
Well, so I did start putting the word out 6 months before I left, because I saw the end coming. Mm-hmm. So I started telling people, hey, listen, I'm going to be going on my own in about, you know, 4 or 5 months. So when that first day started, I literally just started sending out emails, calling people, hey, listen, I'm out here. Let me know what you need. There were people always calling me within that year. And again, unfortunately, the firm I worked for didn't want any of those cases. So I started telling people, listen, I'll probably be out on my own, you know, by the end of the year, hold off and, you know, wait for me to help you out right. with some of that stuff. And to a T, a lot of them did. And the other part, too, is it helps being born and raised in the city. So there were a lot of people who were willing to wait. There were a lot of people that once they heard that, you know, I was out there, that they wanted to support me immediately. And then, I was wise enough to put some money aside mm-hmm. For an instance that if there was going to be a 4 or 5 month just dead zone, I would have been able to survive it. But it's a story that I can't tell people this is how you do it, because right. I don't believe in my case. It was more anything more than preparation and skill, but a lot of good fortune. You know, you remember who introduced us, Deborah and Eric Gold, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
They've been a tremendous influence in my practice. Early on, she and her husband introduced me to, I would say, no less than about 40 influencers like yourself, mm-hmm. either attorneys or doctors who from, you know, that group, like yourself and a few other people, there were about a good 9 or 10 people that immediately said, you know, here, I have something you can work on, or you can help me out with that. So, again, that was just a chance meeting. I met, you know, Deborah at a party that was at Christmas of 2013, I believe, and it was a bunch of doctors and lawyers there. So, you know, it's just been fortunate. And every day.
How and when did you add civil rights litigation to your repertoire?
Okay, so that started about 2016. An office mate of mine, who's a good friend of mine now, like a brother, his name is Derek Steenson. He does almost exclusively criminal defense. But what he did is he brought a few civil cases to me that he needed me to work for him. And then we started to have a discussion about civil rights cases. And then he and I just said, you know what, let's start working some of these cases together. And since then, we have. And interestingly enough, actually, I just got the phone with Verdict Search today, but 2 weeks ago, we just actually did a 2-day jury trial against the city of Philadelphia for malicious prosecution and false imprisonment and assault and battery. Where essentially what happened was a former police officer planted a gun on an individual down in North Philly. He ended up getting charged with the crime. He spent 18 months in jail, which was even worse because he was actually out on parole. So his exposure, if convicted, probably would have been 10 years or more.
Wow.
Needless to say, he was found not guilty back in 2019. We filed suit. Had the jury trial. The jury agreed $200,000 compensatory, $75,000 in punitive damages.
Good for you.
It was great in the sense that first the jury understood what exactly happened, which is that a police officer took the law into his hands and tried to frame someone. And then despite the fact that our client and the city tried to hamper on it, because they didn't want to hamper on the facts. They hampered on the fact that he was an ex-convict and had a past.
Right, his credibility.
Yeah, and that's the first thing they went
right,
to.
Sure, right.
And what I had to do is to say, and it was a ballsy move, but I said, this is the only way I think this jury get it. Put a whiteboard up. And I said, okay, they want to say that our client has no credibility and you can't take his word. I said, fine. Discount everything he said. Just don't even worry about it right now. Let's go with, as the defense counsel just said, the undisputed facts. And what I want you to do is compare them to what the defendant's name was, Officer Cricelli. I said, compare them to Officer Cricelli. And I put everything that was undisputed and I compared it to everything that the officer said. And when they looked at it, it was clear as day. Now I said, now listen to what my client said and tell me how you feel, you know, and I yeah. did the glue, tell me how you feel. I said, it's clear what this officer did, you know, and I had to explain to him that this isn't down with the police. This isn't bigger than, you know,
right.
we're trying to take this system. I said, no, this is one cop that on one day decided that he wasn't going to follow the rules and he wasn't going to follow the procedure. And it just so happened that my client was the one who had to deal with it. Like, you know, I really broke it down. And for as much as people want to say Philadelphia juries are kind of shifting, it wasn't shift that day.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Yeah. First thing I think of is that, I mean, in unless, first of all, congratulations
Thank
on that,
you.
Number one. Number two, if I'm on that jury, it's $1 million. I'm not joking. You're going to send some guy away for 10 years?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, flat out. Let's make it $10 million. I don't care. That, you know, there's got to be a deterrent to son of a guns that are doing stuff like that. We want to throw a man's life away or a woman's life away because they're an easy target.
Yeah.
Okay. You look.
And it seems that kind of thing happens, you know, all too often, and it's very easy for you know, dirty cops to go that far because they know that other cops will have their back.
Well, look at the murder, you know, of George Floyd. Okay, he would be a very easy target. That, you know, in other words, that's what Derek Chauvin was hoping. He just forgot about cell phones. Okay, Chauvin had a good situation without the cell phones. Other cops that were, you know, relatively new weren't gonna. But here's another. You know, as you were speaking, the first thing I thought of was this. I would also think about that cop's record. I'd find out, because if somebody's willing to do something like that, they probably have, okay, my guy's got this, here are the facts, and oh, by the way, I'm sure that guy had some other.
No.
You didn't?
See, this was
why you're the lawyer and I'm not.
No, but you are right, right? So let me tell you about three parts of it. So what is shown is a George Floyd situation happens from a Derek Chauvin because a Derek Chauvin has a jacket.
17 priors.
Right. So I tell people all the time, that cop doesn't wake up that day and kill someone, whether it's by accident or on purpose. It's he's gotten away with a bunch of nonsense over the course of his career.
Right.
And most of the civil rights cases that I have and the officers that we name personally, most of them do have multiple complaints. They have internal affairs complaints, they have disciplinary actions, et cetera. Like, it's a lot. This was actually the first case to where the officer that was involved had a clean jacket.
Wow.
It blew our mind. And it also was why the city really didn't offer us anything. The offer pre-suit was $20,000, which is essentially nothing. They're saying, yeah, we think you got something, but not really. And it was because the officer had nothing, right? But in doing this, he was a 15-year veteran of the drug task force.
Yeah.
And what you generally find is they don't really have records because they are dealing.
They stick together?
Yes, and they're in the belly of the beast, right, dealing with guns and dealing with drugs. And it's very hard to get them on something because, like you said, the blue coat of silence, and then normally the people that they're dealing with, right. Our client had the case I just told you about. That's a situation where he put all his eggs in his basket hoping that a jury would find him not guilty. When most of the time, that case, he's convicted. And once you're convicted, then there's nothing else.
Well, let me give you another shot on that. A lot of times, individuals in that situation don't get the benefit of an attorney like Gary Bailey representing them. So they may end up with the public defender who's got 80 cases and maybe doing the best that can be a great, but having legal counsel like yourself and being able to defend somebody and see that, you know, the forest through the trees and see, you know, what that sometimes, listen, it may sound, you know, even a talented public defender, when you have so many cases, you're going to, you know, it's hard. Like, I'm sure
it's hard for them to come up with a strategy like that.
After about 3 days of pondering, going through this, I'm sure, you know, all of a sudden, bang, here's that aha moment. You had that. If you had 75 other cases, you know, you might have not gotten that, but he had a great attorney, and that individual, in fact, the cop get fired?
No, so because this happened a few years ago, he actually retired, and he works in Bucks County now. So he retired from Philadelphia, and he works out in Bucks County, where I guess he won't be planting guns on anyone anytime soon.
So he's still a police officer.
He's still a police officer. Came in uniform and everything. Yeah, and again, if you all could see the transcript of what he literally testified to something different at four different hearings. Preliminary hearing, two jury trials, and then our jury trial on the civil side. Change the story every time. Like, it was insane.
It's great. You know, you mentioned Sonny in the opening. Gary and I have done a lot of radio together. Mm-hmm. And I said this at the beginning of, before we got on air. Gary said something to me one time. We were doing a show with a primarily African-American audience, and not a secret. Everybody knows about what happened to my dad. You know, but in case you don't know, you know, he was a labor leader, and individuals underneath of him were doing the stupid things. And my father ran the union and the bylaws, and he got caught up in a RICO and is doing 19 years. And if you saw, Gary, if you saw the evidence... Now, we have it on paper, so his attorney, Cheryl Sturm, who is handling his appeals, wrote down the actual, what the prosecutor said to the jury. We're not required to prove that Mr. Dougherty had anything to do or had knowledge of the crimes before they happened, that he was involved in the arson, all these things, but he was the head of the union. Mm-hmm. And everybody who did something said he never told him to do anything. But he did not have a good attorney at the time. And so, but I remember talking to you about it before we went on air. And you said, I think you got to bring this up on the show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a compassionate human being across the board. So, but I also was sitting there saying, well, why would, you know, an audience of black people care about my situation as a white male, and my father is a white male, you know, why would, and Gary said, what did you say?
I said, well, we need to know, because if the system was created for the benefit of your people, if it doesn't work for you, we don't have a shot.
Right.
We have no chance at
justice. And when he said that to me, I went, you got to, you know, all right, I'm in. But I... You know, I sit down and we've talked about a lot of cases like this and the need for criminal justice reform. You know, it's funny because when we talk about the George Floyd case and Derek Chauvin, first thing you said was he's got obviously Chauvin's got a rap sheet to 17 violations. And so, you know, he just didn't get caught at that level. Thank God for cell phones. Having said that, one of the issues Sonny you and Gary know, I do a labor show on Saturday nights. Well, even the head of the AFL-CIO, we were talking about that case, and I think it was not long after it happened. And you know, he said, let's not forget also that I'm friendly with John McNesby over at the FOP, and he does a good job for his members for what his job is, but. At the same time, remember I told you, Gary, we're sitting in the offices of Banks Law right now. You can see all the high-rise mm-hmm. buildings behind us. I worked up on several of them. Several's an understatement. Had I dropped a bucket of bolts one time, my dad was the labor leader, I would have been fired from the job, probably got kicked out of the union. I dropped two or three, and, you know, I come from, my old man would be down there and kick the crap out of me, and I might get thrown out of, or at least skip the year. Mm-hmm. How does this guy... have 17 violations on his record. And the police union still going to the bat. Okay, now he wasn't a Philly guy, and I'm probably pretty sure that McNesby wouldn't be doing that. But my point is, how does he do it? How does somebody,
when is enough?
If I'm your labor leader and you come to me after the third or fourth time, we're in a number five, my answer is going to be, you trip over the curb and it wasn't your fault, I'm going to make sure you get fired. If you're that unlucky after everything you just did, you got four violations. 17. They're an accomplice, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
And so you talk about these, the individuals, these that you represent in these civil rights situations with police, and it's a painful situation. And the question is, how many changes have happened? And I mean, like, in the process, so that we're not set up for failure again in Philadelphia. In other words, you saw what happened with Mr. Wallace, the individual.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I know. Well, I'll tell you one thing that got changed. The city council put tasers in all the police, policemen and women's, they have them now. But the fact is.
And that doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to do the right thing.
Because we saw what happened with the lady who accidentally said she thought she had a taser and booty.
Exactly.
That's a suspect conversation days long.
But, Joe, let me tell you exactly the easiest way, and I stand on this, of how we can change the criminal justice system. So there is a horrible fact in Pennsylvania. I don't want to say the number because it could be wrong, but I'll take a leap of faith. But somewhere between 60% of the felony trials are held as bench trials, meaning no jury, which is kind of insane when you think about it.
Why is that?
Well, I'm about to tell you. Because it's this idea in Philadelphia, for the foremost, but also out in the counties, that if you make a judge go through a jury trial and you lose, he's going to get the phone book and he's going to figure out by how many pages based on how many years he can give you. Like, it's going to be that bad. Now, that's the first side of it. The other side of it is we're not serving on juries. And I'm sure you can attest to that in your career. When you show up and you're looking at the prospective jurors and people are saying anything and everything to get out of jury duty, for every minority that doesn't like the system, if they're not sitting on a jury, then they have taken themselves out of the conversation.
Right.
Because no matter what law Congress puts in play, no matter what's on the city council bill or anything like that, the loudest voice and the most direct and quickest voice is when you swear and take that oath as a juror and you sit on that panel and you argue with your fellow man about what's actually justice. But if you're going to wait for Harrisburg or you're going to wait for Congress down in D.C. to change it, you can forget that.
You got to be a part of the process.
You need millions.
And to add to what Gary is saying, the jury pool is taken from registered voters. And if you don't vote, then, you're not part of the system.
It's
interesting because I've heard the term black robe disease, right? That, a judge who's out of control. My father's in the middle of a situation similar to that. And, I wish it wasn't so. I wish he was as guilty and involved in all that stuff and deserved everything. That way I could look at him and say, hey, Dad, you made a mistake. Okay, now my dad's a rough and tumble guy. So one of the things that if you're a juror and you're coming in from Allentown and you're hearing my dad talk on the phone, it's going to be a shock to you. But if you sat at my dinner table growing up, you might not. He was an iron worker, hardcore dude,
Doesn't mince words.
Right, doesn't. And he's dealing with rough and tumble guys. Sure. Now, having said that, a jury of your peers, what is a jury of your peers? Well, you would think if you're from Philadelphia and all that it would be a Philadelphia, jury who is and understands, my dad's from Philly and if you're on trial and you're from Philly, you should, in my opinion, you shouldn't be, and mostly it's federal, I guess, when you're dealing with those out-of-town juries. But the point is, That it should be a jury of your peers. But also, I think the jury should have something to do with the, you know, the actual sentence. Like, lay the parameters out there.
Certain, certain states have that. And Philly is actually one of the states that, Pennsylvania is one of the few states to where somehow prior legislation disenfranchised Philly when it comes to the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, which sits downtown at a federal building, because the districts and the jury's pool are supposed to be based on the size of the districts. So when you typically go down to the Eastern District and you pull a jury for a case, it blows all of our minds that you could have out of a jury of 12, two people from Philadelphia. When in reality, any jury you have down there should be six people from Philadelphia and six from the neighboring counties, Bucks County, Montgomery County, Delaware County, however far it goes out to. But that's something that was manufactured a few decades ago that they're still trying to change. And
I mean, you know, think about that. On. A few decades ago, and they're still trying to change it.
It's insane. It's
crazy. I mean, I don't think... And I mean this more than anything I've ever said in my entire life. The justice system should not be based on winning. It should be based on justice. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's not guilty and you're a prosecutor and you realize it halfway through the process, that, you know, then you should get a trophy, a big trophy, a Zoom seminar. We'll do a big, you know, presentation, congratulate, because you chose justice over a victory, over a quota of winning. And I know that's not the way it is, but to me, I don't care how many trials you won as a prosecutor. I care about the individual that wasn't able to retain Gary Bailey and therefore, you know, didn't have a chance to have... Right. A successful trial because he's fighting or she's fighting the government. Now, is that really... Well, you don't want to get me started, but you know, if there's no God, then we're all screwed. If there is a God, then the people that are doing that type of stuff, if you're on the prosecutorial side, then you got a real problem. So my point is, there's no way out of this. Yeah. But this is a big story, and like I said this to you plenty of times, Scott. I would have never known this had I not had a father that have gone through it. You just automatically assume you watch the news and somebody's guilty, right? Whoa, 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 back up here. Now I got an, okay. And I guess that's some kind of karma on my side, even though I'm not an insensitive person. I just never had to think about it. But at the same time, it is what it is. One of the things we're going to talk about, it is what it is ain't good enough. Okay, the fact of the matter is that there has to be realistic change, and we have to figure it out. There's, you know, I've said this also as I close up my, get off my pulpit, but, you know, people have said, and there's one person that I get in this argument with on a constant basis every time O.J. Simpson's name comes up. This person's always jumping off to the high heavens about, you know, he's guilty, got away with it. Whoa, 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 whoa. If you're not going... The man was able to afford a world-class defense team, and the system worked for him. Now, whether you believe or not, either way, what about all the people? If you want to jump up and down, jump up and down also for the people that did not have any defense, that right. were not able, mm-hmm. okay, and who are sitting in prison right now, and some law enforcement officer's got some kind of patch on his shoulder or a raise or something like that. And he's in some kind of fantasy world, like he thinks he did something good. And so when he retires, he's got all kinds of commendations. Mm-hmm. Well, the system's set up for that particular situation. Like if anybody got it, and I don't know how many people get into law enforcement and say, you know what, the buck stops here. I'm not going to, but that would be the admirable thing to do. So I can't just go with that's the way it is. Let's go to break. Let's and talk about, you know, we're on it, you know, as we record this, we're the day after Martin Luther King's birthday, since we're talking about civil rights and somebody who has made a difference in so many lives and did evoke change. Let's get into that conversation. You'll have more from the Pain and Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks and his guest Gary Bailey after the break.
Pinnacle Medical Plus is a full-service urine toxicology and durable medical equipment company serving patients throughout the continental United States. With over 25 years of industry experience, the professionals at Pinnacle Medical Plus provide high-quality services and products combined with excellent service at a reasonable price. On the urine toxicology side, Pinnacle is a trusted partner that provides the most up-to-date therapeutic drug monitoring technology. On the DME side, Pinnacle offers an extensive list of premium products along with priority delivery services. At Pinnacle Medical Plus, their number one goal is making sure their customers and patients receive the quality care and services they deserve. Contact Pinnacle Medical Plus for all of your urine toxicology and durable medical equipment needs at 888-396-8644 or online at www.pinnaclemedicalplus.com. Suffering a work injury or any type of personal injury can be a painful and traumatic experience. What can make it even more difficult for a patient is trying to navigate and find the quality medical care they need for their particular injury. Healthmark Enterprises is a full-service medical coordination and marketing company started in 1994 by CEO Robin Lewison that takes all the worry and complications out of treatment for a work or personal injury. From coordinating full-service medical treatment with a top medical professional, providers, and specialists to overseeing patient compliance and providing one-on-one personalized communications with clients. Healthmark Enterprises handles the entire treatment process for injured workers and those suffering personal injuries so they can just concentrate on getting better. Healthmark Enterprises believes that being injured should not limit one's access to great medical care. Now, more than ever, an injured person needs an advocate on their side. Contact Healthmark Enterprises at 215-563-1315. That's 215-563-1315. Healthmark Enterprises.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Pain Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks. We're sponsored by Tony Shore and Pinnacle Medical Plus. Sonny's guest is Gary Bailey of Bailey & Associates, a fantastic civil rights and personal injury attorney in the city of Philadelphia. Also, one of my former co-hosts, esteemed co-hosts. Gary and I have done a lot of meaningful shows together. I remember when we did the show the one time, well, as we started to do the show, we were doing personal, we were doing a lot of different types of attorneys. Mm-hmm. And who was the individual that was on the air before us? Really, really passionate.
Michael Court.
Michael Court, right? Yeah. And so I thought we were just going to do personal injury. And we started doing a lot of civil rights. And I'm like, I think I'm out of my league here. I don't think anybody wants to. He goes, no, we got it. We got to keep the energy up.
And you know what? We should probably have Gary define for our audience what a civil rights case is. Because we talk a lot about personal injury cases on this program. And I bet a lot of listeners may actually have a civil rights case and don't know that they have one.
Okay, sure. So it comes in different form. What we're most knowledgeable about and hear all the time is, again, I guess when you think of Dr. King, right, and his name, we're talking about being discriminated against for you falling in a protected class. And those protected classes generally are race, national origin, sex, religion. And there's some small avenues now that you know, we're evolving as a society. For sexual orientation, you also have age. Then you also have ADA, which is American with Disabilities Act. You have certain like Title IX, which sometimes involves gender discrimination, like you generally hear like with sports. Mm-hmm. Okay, those are the big heavy hitters. So what I try to explain to people, because a lot of times people want to call and they'll say, "Well, I have a civil rights case because my boss is a jerk." And I said, that's unfortunate. He has a right to be a jerk. But he can't be a jerk because you're a man. He can't be a jerk because you're African-American or because you're Muslim. But if he just says, you know what, Joe, that outfit, you got to go.
Hold on for a second. It seems like you're really mean.
You can't. I mean, they can do that. It's unfortunate. I say bosses have a right and out in the general public, people have a right to be, you know, horrible human beings to some degree, and we got to have thick skin. But when it comes to your personal space being invaded or you being subjugated to unfair treatment based on one of those classes, that's when, you know, we can go after you, and that's when we can get compensation and we can deal with it. And another note just to throw in, because I get a lot of calls for employment discrimination cases, mm-hmm. or employment issues. And for anyone that's listening, in Pennsylvania, we have a hard, fast rule that you have to file a complaint with the EEOC before an attorney such as myself can get involved and bring suit on your behalf. And so many people wait a year or more, then come to me and I say, you missed your time frame because you didn't file the EEOC, which is it's between 6 and 9 months. So I always like to tell people, err on the side of 6 months. If something happens, file a notice with them, because two things are going to happen. Either it's going to be unfounded and the EEOC is going to say, well, here's your letter. You can get an attorney. You can sue. Or your boss may get pissed off and then take an adverse employment action against you. Right. So now, whereas though you may not have had a great employment discrimination case on whatever the first act is, but when they retaliate, that's way bigger and that's way easier to prove. Because it's not like we see on TV, right, where someone sent an email using a racial slur, or a boss is punching someone in the face, or they putting up, you know, nooses or, you know, swastikas.
Yeah, it's usually like, not that obvious.
No, that stuff is not happening in real life. So I tell people all the time, unless you have a coworker that's going to co-sign on exactly what you say and willing to push their job on the line, we can't prove this stuff, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. You have to put something in with the EEOC to open up the floodgates of the Discord, to at least let your boss know, hey, somebody's watching you. But we do find that people are not as emotionally mature as you think. And when your boss gets a letter in the mail that the EEOC is investigating them, a lot of times it's hard for them not to react to that.
Right, right.
And they're going to take what's called an adverse employment action. And when they take that adverse employment action, that's when we can come in and we can help you out. Now,
and will the EEOC conduct their own investigation?
It's so rubber stamp cookie cutter. Mm. We're talking about making a phone call, sending a letter, and that's really... Because the reality is, they only really care if it's a wide-scale issue with a big corporation to where they can actually take the case, they can litigate it, and shut someone down.
Sure.
But for some of these smaller places, they're not really concerned. They just want to make sure that they're not missing something that they could take the calls on. Okay, now, the other side, because that was all pretty much just private citizens, when it comes to civil rights as it relates to law enforcement or prosecutors and things like that, that generally comes down to one of two or three things, right, which is a physical injury brought on by law enforcement, right? So police brutality, whether it's physically beating you up, putting you in prison, which is the false imprisonment, or, you know, unfortunately killing you or something like that. That's the obvious. Mm-hmm. The other stuff, which is obvious, but it goes to when you were asking questions about how do we change some of the stuff. Well, it's the cases to where misconduct that goes on every day. You know, I tell people all the time, George Floyd, as unfortunate as it is a situation that happens a couple of times a year, right, in a particular locale. What is never being brought up is the hundreds or even couple thousand of misconduct situations in the police department to where they're falsifying evidence, planting evidence, perjuring themselves on the stand. It never comes up. So that's a civil rights case, too, because if an officer does any of the above, he's violated your civil rights by basically what the law says, initiating criminal charges and a criminal case against you. That's what the statute says. So that's a violation of your civil rights for someone to plant a weapon on you, to purge themselves for the purposes of securing a prosecution against you. And then again, like I said, the obvious is the physical stuff where they're harming you. Officers have a limited right to use of force, and they have a limited right to detain you and withhold you, right? And then we always hear about the Fourth Amendment, too, which is illegal search and seizures if they perform a legal search and that results in you being arrested or locked up. Again, that's a violation of your civil rights, too.
Is it easy? How about getting evidence from them types of situations? I mean, you know, cover-ups are, you know, I'm sure so normal. Otherwise, people wouldn't be doing things like that. Yeah. How do you actually get to the bottom of, you talk about exfoliation in a PI case. How do you get, when you're dealing with police-type cases, how do you actually gather enough evidence?
It's not as hard as you would believe, because the few clients that actually come to us with their case, the first thing, and this is usually the hardest when it comes to non-physical, because those are two different types, right? So the case I told you about earlier, even though we had a physical injury component, the jury didn't necessarily believe that, and they didn't consider that. But for a case that's strictly, you know, planting of evidence, lying, lock you up, take you to jail, the first requirement is that the case has to be disposed of in the plaintiff's favor, right? So they have to be found not guilty or charges dropped or something. They're found guilty or they plead guilty, it's it. They can't bring a claim for that type of case.
Right.
So in cases where they're not guilty, right, or they drop the charges, that's like bullseye, because the prosecution never drops charges. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, the feds have a 98% conviction rate, yeah, and the state is like 85%. So when we get a not, and that's when you ask me how did I get into the civil rights stuff. Well, because Derek Steenson, my great friend in business, he's one of the few attorneys, the criminal defense attorneys, that tries cases. He's not interested in getting deals. He's not interested in having his clients roll over. He looks the prosecutor in the face, like, all right, let's go to trial. Let's
right,
go.
Right.
And the first time he brought me a couple of not guilties, that's when we got into it. So those are the obvious. Now, with the physical, you know, situations such as a person can be, you know, assaulted, rightfully locked up, right?
Yeah.
But if they kick the ever-living crap out of them, or, God forbid, you know, kill them or something like that, it doesn't matter how the case resolves in court, because that officer exceeded his force, right. George Floyd. George Floyd could have righteously been arrested for suspicion of passing counterfeit bills. And that could have been the end of it. Regardless of what would have happened, that would have been the end of it. Chauvin exceeded his force, as we know, in every step of the way, with the knee on the neck and the holding him down and all that. So it wouldn't have mattered what George Floyd's crime was. That would have had no bearing on his civil rights action. Walter Williams, who was shot, and that's a issue, too, because we've dealt with a few cases that where people have mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a case right now that we're litigating to where, actually very similar, a young lady who has some schizophrenia, has some issues. She didn't take her meds that day, same as Walter Williams.
Right.
Her mother called the cops and said, hey, listen, she's off her meds. Can you come get her and take her to the hospital? This wasn't the first time this happened. This happened many times. New officer who, because the local district actually knows who they are, and they had a great relationship with them. New officer on the job showed up. He's pumped up, ready to go. Where's she at? Let me get her, bring her in. He puts her in cuffs, which already is like, come on, they know who she is. She's not. She came down. She's like, okay, I'm ready to go.
Right.
No big deal. Put her in cuffs. Just as a reflex, she spit off to the side of the ground. He took that as, oh, you spit at me. Picked her up and slammed her on the ground, broke her ankle. You know, obviously she has some back issues and stuff like that, but that's a big thing that happens all the time, which is people with these mental illnesses are not treated fairly and they're not respected,
right,
in that exchange.
Let's take it a step farther. Look at the protocols that these officers are following. In other words, a lot of these people are coming out, these police officers are coming out, and they're told to shoot center body, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, by their rules, and I don't know what happened to the two cops that shot Walter Williams, okay, but they're probably, I mean, I could be wrong, but I wouldn't be surprised if nothing happened to them at all, and that their answer was, we followed protocol. When is protocol going to be changed? I mean, does it got to take 7 years? I mean, if I'm a cop, right, and you tell me, this is, I'm being, and you tell me, okay, 75 miles an hour in this 45 miles is no longer a problem. Okay, 45 miles, not of the. Now, I, you know, this is a standard argument that's a little bit juvenile, but, you know, shooting for the knee instead of the chest, right? Okay, a lot of people say you can't do that, whatever. Well, if that's the protocol, that's what I'm doing. I don't. So my point is, yes, it may be personal, and you may have individuals that have plenty of beefs, and it may be a lot of race. But can't we just change the protocols here? I mean, why do we have to wait 5 years
either
before
that,
20 of these things happen?
Give the police a heads up so that they know what kind of situation.
There's a million things I would do. For example, if you're in a high crime area and you have PTSD, okay, and you're no good, you're shot emotionally. You're a cop. You should be taken out of that, you know, high crime area. But, you know, stick them in it behind a desk for 2 years and let them cool down or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, I've had plenty of, you know, as a white guy, I've sat down and you hear something like that. And I'm like, please don't be two white officers in a black guy. Please don't, you know, before I even hear it. Right. Yeah. And so, I'm just saying that you know, the criminal justice reform, police reform and all that. What's taking so long? I mean, we got tasers. Where's the policy? If you're a police officer, your job is not to decide whether somebody's guilty or not. It's to follow protocols. So follow them protocols. And unfortunately, people will be able to set up for.
And in the scenario that Gary just described, I mean, how much of a threat was that woman to that new police officer?
None.
Probably zero.
And my point to you is this, though. Make sure there's a protocol where Gary Bailey walks in and says, you're not, you know, I mean, what was the protocol there? And change the protocol if it allows for somebody to make a call or do something that's going to, devastate somebody.
Mm-hmm. In my opinion, I think three things that has to be done to law enforcing to change. One is you have to pay officers more, but with that you have to have less officers. Like we can't have standing armies in our communities. And the third thing is the officers have to be members of that community. I believe that there's a strong correlation to, especially Philadelphia, to once you allow officers to be able to live in a county but then work here in the city,
they can't
as
an relate
officer,
to their own citizens.
You can't relate. It's just as bad as correctional officers who work in the city and then drive an hour out into the county to work in a prison of people that they have no connection to.
Well,
or live out there in the county.
By the way, that's right. The jury to peer, same thing.
Sure.
You're coming, you can't
I
relate.
I actually thought that was a requirement in Philadelphia, that in order to be a Philadelphia police officer, you had to live within the city limits.
They changed it, to my knowledge, at least 6 or 7 years ago.
Wow.
And look at where we've had the spikes in the crimes with the last two, you know, commissioners that we had. I mean, you have to change those parts because law enforcement has to be invested in serving the community. Mm-hmm. They can't be an occupying force who, by the way, is just looking at how many people we can arrest, how much overtime can we get, how much can we testify in court to get more money, and I need to make detective so I can really get some overtime. Like, to be an officer should be something of pride and determination. You know, people sometimes laugh at me when I say it, but it's the God honest truth. I say, I get enjoyment out of seeing my clients happy with the result, irrespective of what I make. Now, the coded part of that obviously is if I get the best outcome, I'm going to be okay.
Right.
But there's never a situation where I'm looking at a distribution sheet and I'm seeing what I made and I'm happy and my clients looking like, what happened here, and somehow that's okay.
Right.
I do this for the love. I love going into court. I love helping people. I love turning the tables on the insurance companies and the wrongdoers. The money helps me to be able to do it. So as a public servant, we should all share that. And when you're an officer and the first thing you're thinking about is bringing harm to the citizenry or just what you can bilk from the system, you need another job. You have too much power and you have too much influence to boil it down to that little piece.
Right.
You know.
Right.
No question. And as we come towards the end, we got about 7 or 8 minutes left. Martin Luther King as of the recording of this broadcast is his birthday was yesterday. Mm-hmm. So this is going to record. This is going to air
next week.
You know, on Tuesday the 25th. But let's just we're talking about civil rights. We're talking about. In these areas, talk about.
I was going to say, and how appropriate, is it that we have the pending voting rights legislation?
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, it looks like it's going to stall. But
right in 2021, you would think that would not be an issue.
Yeah.
Yep. It should be automatic, bipartisan.
Yeah, no question about that. But having said that, Martin Luther King's birthday yesterday. You listen to this; it's a week past, but. What does that mean to you, Gary, as a civil rights attorney
sure.
and somebody who's passionate about that?
Martin Luther King, and I have to throw this little caveat in there, too, because it's important to me. But Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, to me, are the epitome of the civil rights struggle in the civil rights era. And in particular, you know, Martin Luther King's reach is just, you can't quantify it. Because receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for the work he did, and being misunderstood a lot because of some of the things that Malcolm X said of the strength in the nonviolence movement. You know, I have my own feelings about it, which I won't go into, but I nonetheless respect it tremendously. And quite frankly, this part gets left out a lot when. He and Sonny, obviously being older than me, you can attest to this.
I don't know about that. He's just but, had a rough paper.
But here's the sad part about his legacy and his movement. When the idea of he was just doing it for black people was prominent, it kind of was just being let go. At the point that he was clear that, no, this is bigger than black. This is human rights. Because the government is taking advantage of you and me, Joe, and our family and friends.
Right.
Right? He was killed the day before he was going to do a march for white sanitation workers.
Oh, yeah.
So at the point to where he said this is a human rights issue, that's when he got killed. And that's the part that hurts, my soul.
Oh, yeah. So as a labor, as somebody who's in the labor movement myself, I've done several shows when we were doing the labor show and talking about Martin Luther King's, an article, A Worker's Champion, okay? Funny thing, Martin Luther King, some of his comments in regards to, terms like right to work. Now, right to work is a term in the labor movement, which means you have the right to work without a collective bargaining, so you could be a part of a workforce that has union workers, but you don't have you'll get the same representation,
right.
but you don't have to be in the union. And what that does is eventually, it's a misnomer in regards to it's deceiving. Okay, and Martin Luther King talks about. Here we go. In our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. It is the law to rob us of our civil rights and our job rights. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone. Wherever these laws have been passed, that's right to work, right to work legislation, and you'll find that in anti-union states, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights. Now, Martin Luther King was as much, we talk about, obviously he's delegating for everybody, not just African-American. Whoa. He's as much a labor leader as he is a civil rights leader. Certainly there's so much here, okay? He impacted so many years. I wonder what you think, and I'll say Sonny and Gary, about what Martin Luther King would think of the social justice movement today and where we're at during this day and age.
I don't think he would necessarily like it, because I think he would think that it's not properly focused, because I think it is focused on one race as opposed to the human race, mm-hmm. you know, with Black Lives Matter, et cetera. And that's not what Martin Luther King was about.
And as an African-American male, you know, you've talked about this, you know, many times, that position.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts?
I think is if he wasn't killed, we would be in a better place. I mean, he was one of the most powerful human beings to walk this earth, and his effect would have certainly been felt for years. It's being felt now, so it's unfortunate that him being taken off this earth, this is one of the consequences, and if he was here, we would not have a system like this.
Well, I can tell you this.
In some way.
And in the city of Philadelphia, and I believe this wholeheartedly, especially during the riots, I look around. I thought our mayor dropped the ball. He didn't stand up as a leader. I thought we needed our African-American, and we need more than ever our African-American leaders. We definitely need that because the mayor was afraid to say anything. He didn't want to offend anybody, and therefore with a lack of leadership.
We said it on prior shows, Joe. I think the Philadelphia community is really hurting for an African American leader,
yeah.
Other than you know our pastors and you know our religious folk, we really don't have that true African American leader that could have stepped up in that circumstance, where the mayor did not.
Yeah, and I think right now and it sure doesn't look like it with the running for mayor. I don't think we're going to have. I don't know who's going to be running right now, but. Some of our top African-American political leaders may choose not to run.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that, to me, would be a problem.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. First of all, Gary, I mean, this was fastest hour in radio, man. I mean, we could go on forever.
Phenomenal show. Sure.
Yeah, and we haven't even got started talking about Andrew Walker. And that's a whole nother – that's a 10-hour conversation. But – obviously, it's great that I'll be doing shows with you again.
Me.
And
sure.
If you would, contact information.
Yes, you can reach me at 1500 Walnut Street, Suite 204. Number is 267-225-5442. I'm also on all social media platforms, Gary L. Bailey Jr. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, also Twitter. My email is gbailey@baileylawassociates.com. And although I specialize in personal injury as well as the civil rights stuff, I consider myself a lawyer of the people, especially the Philadelphia community, because you all have been so influential in my career, my growth and development. So if you have a legal issue, feel free to call me. If I can't help you, I'll point you in the right direction.
Absolutely. Well said. Sonny Banks, contact information?
Banks Law, 215-561-1000. Our web address is www.bankslaw.com.
All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Pain and Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks. I want to thank our sponsor, Tony Shore of Pinnacle Medical Plus. I want to thank Andrew Walker for making it happen. Of course, we want to thank Gary Bailey of Bailey & Associates for doing what he does every day for those who cannot fight for themselves, but also for being an awesome guest. And of course, on behalf of Sonny Banks, our host, I'm Joe Doherty. Thanks so much for listening.